picture of quantum field theory to the wave picture. And the plan will be this. First, we'll start with a summary, a quick summary of how space-time expansion can create particles. It's what we did for the past two lectures, and I get a bit of a vibe that it might have been difficult. So I just give you a quick summary again of that. And we will reach the conclusion eventually that the expansion-induced particle production is likely not significant in cosmology. It is significant to know of the possibility, but apparently it didn't actually happen to a significant extent. It's not happening now, and as far as we know, expansion-induced particle production didn't happen to a significant extent in the early universe. And we know that because what we figured out is how it would look like and under which circumstances it comes about. That's why it was important what we did for the past two lectures. And also, the same mathematics can be tweaked a little bit, and we will find out what space-time expansion does for the waves, what it does for the fields rather than for the particles. So we can recycle much of what we did before. So then we will move on to the study of how space-time expansion affects quantum fluctuation. Namely, it does what is called amplification of the quantum fluctuation. Not exactly the right terminology, as you will see. It's not really an amplification of quantum fluctuation. that's the term that's being used. And the conclusion that we will reach when we study the effect that space-time expansion has on quantum fluctuations of fields, the conclusion that we will reach is that these quantum fluctuations apparently were very important in the very, very early universe, and that they were the source of all the inhomogeneities in the universe, in particular also the inhomogeneities that we see in the cosmic microwave background. Particle production is not that significant, and we will see how currently we believe matter came about. It was not produced by an expansion per se, but by the decay of a potential. So we start with a summary of how space-time expansion can create particles. Remember, the quantum field chi, which is not directly the physical field, it is the scale factor times the physical field. So remember that the quantum field has to obey the hermeticity conditions, the canonical commutation relations, and the Gordon equation. The solution to these three conditions is given by that expansion, where the vk of eta is any mode function. You can choose any mode function. This any complex valued solution of both the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. The Wronskian condition being equivalent to the imposition of the canonical commutation relations. Then we saw that assuming we have an ultraviolet and an infrared cutoff, and we can choose them very remote so that they don't affect our predictions. So we found that assuming an ultraviolet and an infrared cutoff, a theorem by Stone and von Neumann applies, which guarantees that the solution is actually unique, even though we have a huge amount of choice in what mode function we use. And this means that the same solution, chi hat k of eta, can be written in different ways. So we may choose different mode functions there, but we always represent the same solution. Now remember that with the choice of mode function, let's say the untilded ones, come operators A and A dagger, which we don't put tildes on. If we choose another mode function, we may put tildes on it to to distinguish it from the first, and then also the A and the A dagger operators acquire tildes so that we can distinguish them from the first A and A dagger operator. Then we can define vectors 0 or 0 tilde as the vectors that are being annihilated by the A or by the A tilde. Obviously, since the A are different operators from the A tilde, this is going to be different vector from that vector. We can apply A dagger operators on those vectors, either untilded or with a tilde, and you know we can build up an orthonormal basis of our Hilbert space in this way, either using the untilded quantities or the tilded ones. Since this is an equivalent representation of always the same solution, everything happens in the same Hilbert space, this is a basis of the same Hilbert space as that, so there must be a unitary transformation, a change of basis, which gets us from this basis to that basis. Remember that so far this is all about math. There's nothing to do with vacuum, right? Nothing to do with what might be the vacuum vector. It's just to say that the same solution can be written in different ways, and that the vectors that we obtain in this way must be related by some unitary transformation. Okay, so how does the change of basis look like? Well, since the solution space of the Klein-Gordon equation, and by that I mean the decoupled Klein-Gordon equation, so this one, we've done the Fourier transform in conformal time and co-moving coordinate. So this is an independent Klein-Gordon equation for each value of k, for each mode k. So the statement is that since the solution of this Klein-Gordon equation is two-dimensional, the solution space is two-dimensional, two complex dimensional because it's second order in time, this differential equation, any two linearly independent solutions will span this solution space. If V is a complex solution, then V star is a linearly independent complex solution. So the two of them will span the solution space. This means that if V is a mode function, then together with V star, it spans the solution space of the Klein-Gordon equation. Therefore, if V tilde is another mode function, it simply has to be a linear combination of those two basis vectors in the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Therefore, any mode function can be expressed as a linear combination of some arbitrary mode function and its complex conjugate. And there must be linear combination coefficients alpha and beta that do the trick. Knowing this, and knowing that equivalence, you can express V tilde in terms of alpha, beta, and the V star, and then read off from the comparison of those two equations what the A tilde are in terms of the A, and vice versa. So, knowing that V tilde is a linear combination of V and V star with some coefficients alpha and beta, we can easily derive from the above equation that, therefore, the untilded A must be a linear combination of the tilded A and its and the A tilde K minus K dagger with these coefficients alpha star and beta here. Not the typo, this really has to be alpha star. Now that's very useful to know that this operator is a linear, simple linear combination of these two. Because that is the key to calculating how one of the two orthonormal bases, remember this, how this set of basis vectors can be expressed in terms of that set of basis vectors and vice versa. Namely, remember, the defining equation for the vector 0 is that A annihilates it. But now, this equation we can solve expressed entirely in terms of the tilded quantity. A can be expressed in terms of the tilded quantities like this. And the vector 0 is some as yet unknown linear combination of the tilded basis vectors. So now you can write down this thing as an equation in tilde quantities, which we can then solve for this as yet unknown linear combination that the vector 0 is in terms of the tilde basis. And the solution is that the untilded 0 has to be that linear combination of basis vectors, of tilde basis vectors. So now that we know how this vector looks like in the tilde basis, maybe like that, a big linear combination. It's a big linear combination. Now that we know that how this vector looks like in the tilde basis, we also know how a dagger k acting on that looks in this basis. And that's because a dagger k can also be expressed in terms of the tilde a and the tilde a dagger because of this equation. Simply put a dagger on everything, right? And then you find out how a dagger k acts on this. So all of the untilded basis vectors can be explicitly expressed in terms of the tilde ones. So we have that change of basis. So far, it's all been just the math of the representation theory of the canonical commutation relations and therefore the solution. Now, a separate but related physical question rather than mathematical question is the question, which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector at a given point in time? And by vacuum, we always mean the state without particles, if there is such a state. You could imagine a situation where it's impossible not to have particles. You could have a situation where part of the universe is, I don't know, expanding wildly while the other part is contracting wildly, another part is just sitting idle. Maybe in this scenario, there is just no state in which there are no particles. But we are not looking at such complicated situations. We're always looking at Friedman, Robertson, Walker scenarios for now. So in this limited class of space-time, let's see, can we identify at an arbitrary point in time what the vacuum vector might be, the no particle state? Well, in principle, we have to admit that the vacuum state could be a different state at any point in time. The vacuum state might be described by one Hilbert space vector now, and the vacuum state may be described by another Hilbert space vector at a later time. This would mean that particles are being created. Okay? Remember, this is exactly the statement that particles can be created. If the vacuum vector were always the same, then particles would never be created by the expansion because we are working in the Heisenberg picture here, and the state of the system never changes. So if the system starts out in the vacuum state, and that state is always the vacuum state, well, then the system always stays in vacuum state. So particles are being created if and only if the vector that describes the vacuum changes over time, okay? Working in the Heisenberg picture. So in principle, we have to admit that this is a possibility. The vacuum state may be different at different times. This can happen. Particles may be created. Now, if at a time eta there exists a no particle state, and as we said, there can be doubt about the existence of such a state, also because, as we saw, the harmonic oscillators of the modes can turn into inverted harmonic oscillators, in which case they don't have a discrete spectrum which could count the number of particles that are there. So, but we found, we arrived at the following. We said, if at the time eta there exists a no particle state, which we may call vacuum at eta, then we can ask, is it the vector zero arising with the suitable mode function vk? This would be a plausible proposition. Because after all, we know that if that were the case, then we could easily write down all the one particle, two particle, three particle states, and so on, simply by applying creation operators. It all matches up very nicely because we know that if you apply the creation operator repeatedly, it will just add the right amount of mass and energy and so on and momentum to the system consistent with having that many particles. But then we know that there are plenty of those candidates. There's the vector zero, there's the vector zero tilde. You know, for any mode function, there's another choice. So the question is, at any given time eta, if there is a vacuum state, is it one of those? And if so, which one? Or more precisely, or more concretely, which mode function would induce the right vector zero? Well, we studied that question and we found that, yes, we can make this identification at least under one condition. Namely, if the evolution of the universe happens to be adiabatic around the time eta in question that we're interested in, at least in that situation, we think we know how to identify the vacuum state, and we think we know that it's one of those. And we think we know which mode function it is, such that its creation annihilation operators are such that the vector that is annihilated by it A is this vacuum vector at A, at eta. And we found a rather complicated answer, complicated looking answer. We found that if the universe is evolving adiabatically, at least around the time eta, then the vacuum state at the time eta exists, and it is the vector zero that arises with the following mode function. It's the vector zero that arises with the mode function vk, which at the time eta obeys these two initial conditions here. It takes this amplitude, which is given by 1 over the square root of the frequency at the time eta, and its amplitude derivative is given by this. Now, if this were a Minkowski space, then there would be no omega prime. The time derivative of the frequency vanishes, and we would have this term is absent, so these conditions would give us the vacuum in Minkowski space. Well, these conditions also give us the vacuum in Minkowski space. It's just that this term makes no difference, right? So the key thing is that there seems to be some correction here. Something's going on about this term that takes into account that the universe is expanding. Remember that we had tried to identify the vacuum state as the minimum energy state, and that would have led us to abandoning this term. And we found that this is not the right prescription because it would predict a huge amount of particle production that we don't see even in the current day universe. Before I go more into reviewing the logic for that, let me just point out again that this is our prescription for identifying which vector describes the vacuum at time eta if the universe evolves adiabatically around the time eta. Otherwise, if the universe happens to evolve non-adiabatically at around the time eta, then there's no reason to believe that this is the right criterion. We haven't derived it for other cases. It may be true, it may not. It's just not clear why it would be the right one. Also, there are circumstances where for sure we know that this is not the right criterion, and that is when omega squared is negative. Remember that this can happen when the acceleration of the universe is too strong. Then the frequency actually turns, the frequency squared turns negative. The frequency turns imaginary. And instead of oscillations, this harmonic oscillator doesn't have sine and cosine solutions. It has hyperbolic sine and hyperbolic cosine solutions. And, you know, generally it has exponential increase or exponential decreasing solutions.
You said that the feedback evolution means slow with respect to frequency. Yeah. But we have multiple frequencies here. So do we have to make sure that our ultraviolet cutoff is consistent with how slow we want our illusion to be? Or
when you say there are multiple frequencies, yeah, what do you mean? You mean you have multiple k?
Well, yeah, there would be multiple k.
Yes, yes, very good point. On these considerations, I really didn't speak carefully enough, you're right. Because for some modes, the evolution of the universe may be adiabatic, whereas for other modes, it may not be adiabatic. And that's because, for example, we know that this omega squared can be negative for some modes and positive for other modes. So really, all of this discussion has to be qualified by saying that it applies to one particular case. Some modes may be adiabatically evolving, others may not. For some modes, we may know what the vacuum state is, and for others, we may not. Now, I keep harping on this thing here that this might turn negative the omega squared. Now, for the particle interpretation, it's a headache because it means we don't know what to make of it. But actually, when we now switch very soon to the wave picture, we will find that this is the most interesting phase. And it will occur in cosmology, and it will have a huge impact. This is the phase in which quantum fluctuations are being amplified. It's just that we can't speak of them in terms of particles at this point. We can only talk in terms of waves or fields and their quantum fluctuations, but not in terms of particles. Okay, so why did we identify, just a quick review again, why did we identify the vacuum state using those conditions here, the adiabatic vacuum condition? Why those? We looked at the case where the evolution is adiabatic. Adiabatic at least for the mode K in question. Okay? And we looked at the case where the evolution is adiabatic in an interval. Let's say from time eta 1 to time eta 2. Maybe short time interval, maybe long time interval. A short time interval will do. So look at this situation. Evolution is adiabatic. Now, physically, what would we predict? What would we expect? We would expect that there is no particle production in this interval. If you have a harmonic oscillator, such as a pendulum, and you change its parameter in the way that you would in order to get parametric excitation, but you change the parameter very slowly as compared to the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator, well, then you just won't find parametric excitation. So we would expect that as long as the evolution is adiabatic for the mode in question, in a period from time eta 1 to eta 2, we would expect that we predict no particle creation. Well, adiabatic means slow changes compared to the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator.
No, but what is the natural?
The natural frequency is omega.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So omega prime over omega squared is small. It's a number. It's a pure number. The units cancel. Omega prime over omega squared is small compared to 1. And omega double prime over omega to the third power is also a unitless number. It, too, has to be small compared to 1. Okay, so this is what we expect. Now, the equations AV, those two conditions on the amplitude, and the derivative, those two conditions, actually, as we verified, or I hope you verified in exercise, those two conditions are actually obeyed in this interval here by a single mode function VK. So look, this is the key claim here. This is the key finding, that those conditions, those two conditions here, are obeyed in this time interval by one mode function. If you choose another, any other condition here, for example, you drop this thing, okay, then you will find that in an interval of adiabaticity, at either one, then your conditions will be obeyed by one mode function, at another time by another mode function, another time by another mode function. Okay? These conditions are special because they are obeyed by one single mode function in this entire interval. But what does that mean? One mode function means one vector zero. Okay? It means that in this entire interval, we identify the same vector zero as the vacuum vector, which is to say, no particle creation. All right? Should I repeat that point? It's very important. Okay, so just once again, these are the unique conditions that you can put on a mode function that are obeyed by one single mode function in a period of adiabaticity. And since you have the same mode function singled out at every point in time in this interval of adiabaticity, you have one single vector zero, and the one that comes with this mode function, singled out at every point in time in this interval of adiabaticity. But then remember what we just said before, namely that if the vacuum is described by the same Hilbert space vector in a period of time, it means that in this period of time, no particles are being created. That's because we work in the Heisenberg picture, and the system is always in the same state. So if it started out at the beginning of the interval, being in a vacuum state, then it's still in the same Hilbert space state, so it's still described by the same Hilbert space vector in the entire interval. And in the entire interval, that is the vacuum vector. So no particles are being created. Okay? So this is the unique condition that singles that out. And this is what we wanted. We wanted a vacuum identification criterion which predicts no particle creation during adiabatic evolution. And that's what we achieved. Now, let us look at what this mode function looks like, and maybe we get a hint as to what this thing here is about and why it's not the minimum energy state. Okay, so what is this mode function, the unique one that obeys the same condition in the entire interval here? Well, that is the mode function. Well, at least this is the mode function up to corrections to the adiabatic approximation. So within the adiabatic approximation, this is the mode function. Okay, just 1 over the square root of the frequency times that integral. And if the frequency is not time dependent, as in Minkowski space, if it's not time dependent, then this integral turns out to be simply eta 2 minus eta 1. Okay, so it's just the usual Minkowski mode function, e to the power of I, eta 2 minus eta 1 times omega k. Otherwise, it's the integral there. Okay, so that is this mode function. And here I'm just saying that, yes, this is the mode function that satisfies this AV criterion for all time in this interval. Therefore, it specifies the same A and A dagger operators in the same in this interval, and therefore the same vector zero, and therefore the same vacuum, and therefore no particle creation. The experimental evidence is, as we mentioned, in favor of all of this. The astronomical observations are that the universe is currently evolving adiabatically. We don't see much action. It's not that we see things flying away in a hugely accelerated way, even though apparently the universe is accelerating. It's not dramatic, not yet anyway. And there's also currently no evidence for expansion-induced particle creation today or in the past. Now, let's get back to getting some intuition. One of you asked, you know, any intuition for why it's not the lowest energy state? Okay, I changed the slides a little bit to put something in there to give some intuition about it. So we tried the idea that the vacuum state might be the lowest energy state. This, however, predicted copious particle production even now. And that was ruled out. Now, what's the intuition behind the extra term? Right? Let us look at the vacuum identification criterion again. Here, this extra term, what is this about? Well, if we drop this thing then the criterion is picking out the minimum energy state. And more precisely, if you look at it, as far as the mode function is concerned, it is picking out that mode function which has the right frequency adjusted to the harmonic oscillator. How do we identify the frequency of a mode function anyway? You see, the frequency of a harmonic oscillator is easily identified. Omega k of eta, right? That's the frequency of the harmonic oscillator at a point in time. But what is the frequency of a solution to the harmonic oscillator? You see, if you have a pendulum and or any other harmonic oscillator, and you have it do its pendulum thing, and you change its parameters, change its mass, or change the length of the string, or something like this, then you are instantaneously changing the frequency of that harmonic oscillator. But does that mean that the solution instantly adapts to it? For sure, if you start with a long pendulum, a low frequency, have it do its oscillation, it will oscillate at the frequency omega. And then you shorten the pendulum, it will have a new frequency, and after a while, for sure, the thing will oscillate with a new frequency. But as you go through a frequency range, will the frequency of the solution immediately, instantaneously match the frequency of the harmonic oscillator? Well, first of all, to be precise, the question isn't precise. Because what is the frequency of a function at a point? By the time frequency uncertainty principle, we would say there's no such thing as fixing the frequency of a wave at a point. However, here we seem to be insisting on doing such a thing. So we have to be clever about this and try to identify what the frequency of a wave is in some sense. There is known a notion of instantaneous frequency in signal processing. So if you have e to the power of I omega t, for example, or say eta, then we know what the frequency of that solution is. It's omega. Now, how can we, let's say V of eta is this. How can we extract that omega from this? If you don't know exactly how this thing looks like, just as a general procedure, how would you extract the number omega from V of eta? Well, what you can do is you can take V prime of eta. This will get down an I omega factor, multiply with minus I, that gets rid of the I, and then divide by V of eta, right? This is omega. Okay? So V prime over V, up to prefect of minus I, is the frequency of the solution. But you see, this can be used as a general definition of the frequency, even if the thing is not simply a plane wave. And in signal processing, that's what they would call instantaneous frequency. You take your signal, take the time derivative, divide by V, multiply by minus I, and then you get something, right? It's a number. And you know that if the frequency is pretty much constant, then you get pretty much what you would expect. But in this case here, we have some adiabatic evolution of the frequency, and we can ask, what is this adiabatic frequency looking like? I mean, what is the time-dependent frequency of the solution? Is it really always the omega of the... no, actually, let's call this F, right? Because there's no guarantee that this is actually the same as the omega of eta. Omega of eta is the parameter that occurs in the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator. Here we have the solution, and whatever that ratio is, we know matches the omega in a case of constant frequency, but may not if the frequency is not constant. And this is exactly what's happening here. If you take our actual solution, this one, and now you calculate what this is, minus I, V prime over V, in the case of adiabatic change of the frequency, then what happens? See, we actually get a contribution from here and from there. And what you find is that V prime minus I V prime over V, the instantaneous frequency that is so defined here, is omega k of omega, the instantaneous frequency of the harmonic oscillator at the time, plus this extra term, which is simply saying that the solution is not instantaneously following what the harmonic oscillator dictates. The harmonic oscillator has its own resonance frequency, but the solution can't be expected to match the resonance frequency immediately. It takes a little while to settle into it. And that gives us this correction term here. And if you look at it, that is exactly the correction term that we have up here. If you look at, and this correction term here is exactly that. You see, no wonder. We calculate V prime over V, right? So V prime over V is picking up an extra term, namely this one. Okay? So that little bit makes all the difference between too many particles being produced nowadays or no observable amount of particles being produced now. And remember that this is not all that strange if you think about harmonic oscillators. If you have a harmonic oscillator and you put some friction into it, then the friction too will change its resonance frequency. Right? So there are several things that can impact the frequency of the solution and make it deviate from the plain resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator if there were no other influence on it. Okay. So now, after this review of the particle picture, we start moving to the wave picture.
What is it telling us? It's telling us that it's that term is small and the frequency shift is small?
Yes. The frequency shift is small, but well, what we saw is that the difference between the lowest energy state and the adiabatically defined vacuum state, the actual vacuum state, is small, but experimentally clearly distinguishable. If we had made the wrong identification as the lowest energy state, then we would be predicting too many particles being produced.
No, I'm talking about that. What is a small energy frequency? How is it explaining?
It tells us that we have to identify the vacuum states this way, with the correction term, not without. Okay, so what we did so far can be put in this form. We studied the effect of space-time expansion on this type of operator, on the number operator. We studied the effect of space-time expansion on the creation of particles, right? So we might have been, the universe might have started out with this expectation value being zero, and then eventually, if the evolution was non-adiabatic, this expectation value may become large. But there are problems with this. You see, the interpretation of a state zero as the vacuum state, we found at most holds if the mode oscillators are not inverted, because otherwise the whole picture of particles breaks down. And this as long as omega squared is positive. But as we will see in cosmology, this is not always the case. And in fact, the most interesting period in the early evolution of the universe is when omega squared turns negative. And of course, it can turn negative for different modes at different times. But a lot of modes will have a period in which they are at negative frequency squared. And that's going to be the most interesting period. And the particle picture is just not appropriate for this. So now, can we go to the wave picture? See, another way of looking at why the particle picture is not so important as not as important as the wave picture in cosmology is this. In cosmology, interactions turn out to be such that effectively the field observables, phi hat of x, are more important than particle observables such as n hat. Both are self-adjoint operators. This one measures how many particles there are in a particular mode. This one measures how big the field is or its fluctuation. And what we will find in cosmology is that really those guys are more important than these. But why would that be? From particle physics and quantum mechanics, we know that it really ought to be that. No, particle physics is all about particles crashing into another and so on, and you never ever measure such a thing as a phi in the field observers themselves. And I should say, it's not just the phi, it's also the d mu phi. Let me just fix this, because it's important. See, these are self-adjoint things as well, and together they enter into the energy-momentum tensor. So how is it that those field observables are more important than these? Well, roughly speaking, the reason why those are not so important is that there are very few particles. The density of particles is not all that high in cosmology. It's not like the density of particles on Earth or in a collision in an accelerator. The particles are pretty sparse in the universe on average. And on the other hand, as we will now see, quantum field fluctuations are going to be what is called amplified. In fact, in that period in which the harmonic oscillators have this inverted potential. And why would it matter that field fluctuations become amplified? Well, you see, when the field fluctuations become amplified, then the energy-momentum tensor, which is the polynomial in those things, the energy-momentum tensor is going to have huge fluctuations. But the energy-momentum tensor couples through the Einstein equation through the curvature and therefore leads to curvature fluctuations. But curvature affects the dynamics of everything, including the quantum microwave background. Okay, so with this said, let us study the effect of space-time expansion on the field's vacuum fluctuation. Strategy will be this. First, we consider the typical amplitude of quantum fluctuation as a function of their spatial size. Obviously, while quantum fluctuations of wavelength 1 meter can occur, they seem to be unlikely. It's not that suddenly we have huge electromagnetic field fluctuations on a wavelength of 1 meter. We would know about them if they were there. But on the other hand, if we look at a situation in vacuum, I'm just talking about the vacuum for the moment. Think you have a room that's completely empty and not even air, just total vacuum, let's say out there in space. And you make sure that it's like a Faraday cage. No external electric and magnetic fields will penetrate. And you can ask, well, are there going to be electric and magnetic fields in there? And the answer is yes, at least some quantum fluctuations. We calculated that at the beginning of the course already, namely that there ought to be some fluctuations of all kinds of fields. But then we know that they are not going to be very significant, not very large, at least not the macroscopically large ones. We don't expect strong electromagnetic field fluctuations of a wavelength of 1 meter, because we would have seen them if they were very prominent. But on the other hand, maybe there are stronger fluctuations at shorter wavelengths. Maybe at extremely short wavelengths, there are strong, very strong fluctuations, and this is actually the case. So the first thing we will study is, how does the amplitude, the typical amplitude of a quantum fluctuation of a field, depend on the wavelength of the quantum fluctuation? We look at it as a function of the wavelength of the quantum fluctuation. And then, B, we will check how that relationship is affected by cosmic expansion. So we will find a particular curve, functional behavior, that tells us quantum fluctuations of this wavelength are typically that amplitude, quantum fluctuations of this wavelength are typically that amplitude. And then we find that this relationship between amplitude of quantum fluctuations of fields and their wavelength will be modified through expansion and will be most strongly modified when we have this inverted potential for the mode oscillator. As you may imagine, I mean, you can already anticipate this, because for a harmonic oscillator that has this sort of shape in the ground state, you have some quantum fluctuations, some zero-point fluctuations about the origin, right? That's all. And then if the harmonic oscillator opens up a little bit, well, you might have more of a, the Gaussian might be wider, okay? But what happens if the potential goes like this? Then the quantum fluctuations really go without bound. Not quite that easy, though. You see, this is the picture that has led people to say that the quantum fluctuations are being amplified, because if the potential is inverted, then you get these runaway solutions, and that's what they call the amplification. It's not quite true, because remember that our harmonic oscillators are harmonic oscillators for the chi fields, not for the phi fields. The phi fields have this friction term in them as well. So what we will find is that for the chi fields, yes, we have this runaway, we have this amplification and so on, but for the phi fields, it will have a slightly different feel, as we will see, because of this friction term and so on. Basically, the chi field is, you see, the chi field is related to the phi field in a time-dependent fashion, and the fluctuations are time-dependent, so overall, it's not really going to be as simple as simply saying that it was an amplification. It's more like a freezing. It's more like quantum fluctuations that are very large amplitude when they are very small scale will, when they are being expanded, keep their amplitude. See, quantum fluctuations of very short wavelength normally have large amplitude. It's normal. And then the expansion of space-time will simply mean that they keep their large amplitude when you expand them. All right, so this is the general strategy. We consider the typical amplitude as a function of the wavelength, and then we see how that's affected by expansion. Okay, we start with the definition. Actually, sort of a review of what we already hinted at the beginning of the course. Consider a real-valued function f from R3 into R. And let's fix a time, let's say eta naught. Then we define a state of the quantum field f, normalized state f, as the joint eigenstate of all the field operators phi hat of x and eta naught with eigenvalues f of x. So the vector f is, by definition, that normalized vector in the Hilbert space, if it exists. We have to assume here ultraviolet and infrared cutoff. So f is, in effect, that normalized vector in the Hilbert space which is eigenvector to all the field operators. For each x, we have another field operator, another self-adjoint operator, phi hat of x. And the eigenvalue of the operator phi hat of x at x is the number f of x. Okay? See that? So this is an infinite number of eigenvalue equation. Whenever you hold the time and the place fixed, so we work in just one point in time, eta naught, right? So we hold one place fixed x, one place x we hold fixed. At this point, we have a field operator phi hat of x, self-adjoint operator. This vector is, by definition, an eigenvector to this operator, namely the eigenvector which has this eigenvalue, f of x. So the function f of x is really a collection of eigenvalues. If the quantum field is in an arbitrary state, and you go out there and you measure phi hat of x at every point in space. If you could do this, you would get at every point in space a real number. So you would obtain a function from R3 into R. Okay? And after you've measured that, after you've measured all those measurements, the system, the quantum field, is in an eigenstate to all those field operators, and that's going to be this state with the eigenvalues that you measured at all those points. Now, if the system were in such a state, if the quantum field were in such a state, in a joint eigenstate of all the phi hat operators, then there would be no quantum fluctuations. Simply it's simply the statement that if in quantum theory you measure an observable, then after you've measured, the system is in an eigenstate to that observable. So if you measure again right away, there's no doubt that what you will measure. You will find the same value again. The system didn't have time yet to evolve away from that. And if it's in an eigenstate, then the variance is zero. Namely, if you calculate the expectation value of the field operator at the point x, phi bar, and of course we haven't evolved things in time, it's still the time eta naught, then this expectation value is given by, you know, the state F, field operator in here. Now, the field operator acting on F just gives us the function F of X, which is number valued. We can pull it out of the bracket. And then we have here F, it's a normalized vector, so it's just F of X. We simply measure again what we've already measured. If we prepare the system by measurement, let's say, in a state F, then if we measure again, we just find that again. So the expectation value is what we prepared it in. Now, what's the variance? Well, this is the usual calculation of finding the variance in an eigenstate. It's zero. So the variance of phi is the actual observable minus the expectation value squared. It's a squared deviation from the mean. That's what the variance is. If we calculate that, you see the phi hat acting on F just gives us the function F. Obviously, this is just zero here. So it seems that quantum fluctuations are not necessary. In principle, we could arrange for a box, a Faraday cage, a box of vacuum in which there's just no fields, no field fluctuation. And that's not so, because such a state would cost an infinite amount of energy. Exactly for the same reason that you cannot, in a harmonic oscillator, nail your particle to any particular point in space. You can't have your particle simply sit there at the origin of the harmonic oscillator. You may think, why not? The position eigenvector. Why can I not put it in a position eigenvector? Well, you cannot, because if the expectation in X, if the uncertainty in X were zero, and that would be the case if you nail your particle at one point in space, then the uncertainty in momentum would have to be infinite by the uncertainty principle. But that would mean that the expectation value of P squared would have to be infinite. But that occurs in the kinetic term. It occurs in the Hamiltonian. So the energy would have to be infinite. Now, and not only for the harmonic oscillator, I mean, no particle can be put into a position eigenstate because it would cost an infinite amount of energy. In our case here, it's just the same. The quantum field cannot be put into a field eigenstate F, because the expectation value for the Hamiltonian would be infinite. I leave it to you as an exercise to show this, but I already gave you a hint, namely for these states, F, for these field operator eigenstates, the uncertainty in the field operator would always be zero. But we have an uncertainty principle between delta phi and delta pi, where pi is the canonical conjugate field, And so the uncertainty in pi would be infinite. Sorry, I wrote pi here, but it ought to be. Pi to be consistent. But the Hamiltonian contains the term pi squared, and therefore the expectation value of the Hamiltonian would also be divergent. Okay, so quantum fluctuations of fields are always with us. There's just no way that we could get around them. Now, a crucial consequence of that is that, well, as I just said, any eigenstate would have infinite energy, and therefore all finite energy states, all realistic states, do possess quantum fluctuations. Now, let us assume that the system is therefore in some finite energy state psi, which is obviously not a field eigenstate. Now, assume that at the time eta naught, we could measure phi hat of x for all x. So let us assume we could go out there and measure the field amplitudes. We know we can't, because it would cost an infinite amount of energy. But for the moment, let's just think we could. Then what would be the probability for finding the values f of x? Well, you see, if we found the values f of x, the system would be in the state f. So therefore, what we are asking is, assuming the state of the system is psi, what's the probability for finding the system in the state f if we measure the field amplitudes? And that's, of course, simply, as always in quantum theory, the modulus squared of the overlap. And without the modulus squared, it's just the probability amplitude. Remember how this looked like in Minkowski space. If the system is in the vacuum state, then the probability for finding a particular field configuration f, so for finding particular eigenvalues f of x at the positions x, is given by the modulus squared of the overlap between the Minkowski vacuum state and that position dependent function f that describes a state f, a modulus squared. And that we calculated to be this expression here, up to normalization factor. It's this term here which describes an exponential suppression. It's e to the power of minus, and then this exponent, where fk are the Fourier coefficients of the function f that we are asking for. So we are saying, assume the system is in the Minkowski vacuum state. Let us look at a field, particular fluctuations. See, I'm just drawing here field amplitudes. So this is x, y, and this would be level curves of field amplitudes. so this would be f of x1, x2, x3. Then we can ask, what's the probability of finding exactly this field configuration? Well, the probability is, apart from a normalization factor, this thing here. All we have to do is take the function f of x1, x2, x3, and do the Fourier transform. Assuming that we have an infrared cutoff, this is a Fourier series transform, and the Fourier series coefficients are the fk. Then we plug that in here, and we obtain this probability. Notice here that this probability for finding a particular field configuration is time independent. And that's simply because the in Minkowski space, everything is time independent. But we should not expect that this calculation has a time independent answer in the case of an expanding space time. Now, before we move on to doing this in the case of expanding space-time, let's try to make things a little more realistic and a little bit more easy to handle. We start by remembering that it is not realistic to measure all the field operators phi hat of x at every point in space individually. Because for one thing, we don't know how that apparatus would look like that does that, that measures the field amplitude at every point independently. And secondly, we know that if we could, it would cost an infinite amount of energy. So we don't even need to try. But still, we would like to know the probability for measuring fluctuations of a particular wavelength or of a particular size. And that, at least, we can actually do. See, realistically, we could measure an average of the values of the field over a region B. So you could imagine having a machine that doesn't measure the electric field at a point. It just can't have a detector that's truly a point. But we could imagine a machine that measures the average of an electric field over a region. That region may be small. The region may be large. But some finite region, that's sort of realistic. So the machine never knows or never is able to tell us what the finer structure of the electric field might be. No, it's just measuring the average over a patch, the patch being three-dimensional. Now, what would be quantum mechanically the observable that this detector is measuring? How do we mathematically describe this? How do we describe a measurement that averages over a region? There's got to be some self-adjoint operator for that, and that we can then use and calculate what its expectation value is, what its variance is, and so on. And surely we can do this. You see, this is going to be the right operator. Take the field operators at all points in space, and then smear them over a region in space. Smear them over the region B. So assume that W of X is what is called a window function. It's a function that is zero outside the region B, and that has amplitude 1 over the volume in the region B. So that when you integrate over just the window function, you get 1. So when you integrate our quantum field over that, over R3 with this window function, you get really an operator that expresses taking the average of the field in this region. And I'm not saying that this should be theta function. This need not be exactly 0 outside and exactly v to the power minus 1 inside. It's actually preferable to have something that is more smooth, that is pretty much 1 over v inside, but then it drops off smoothly towards 0 to the outside. And the reason is that the Fourier transform of W will be needed, and we don't want it to show unnecessarily high frequencies. See, if you have a function that drops from a finite value to 0 very steeply, then you get that the Fourier transform has some high frequencies in it. That's absolutely not necessary, and so we better avoid them. So think of W as a function that smoothly turns to 0 rather than sharply. You will soon see why we want to do this. So let's apply this now not to Minkowski space, but to general FRW spacetimes, which of course includes Minkowski space. So we choose the conformal time eta and co-moving coordinates x. And we choose a region B of size L cross L cross L. So it's a box. Doesn't have to be a box, could be a ball, doesn't matter. Now, in proper coordinates, this is a box of increasing size. Okay? Because these, you see, we work in a co-moving coordinate system. In a co-moving coordinate system, if you hold coordinates fixed, then because the co-moving coordinate system is expanding with the space-time, it means that the actual physical region that you describe gets bigger and bigger. We have to make a choice. I mean, we either hold the proper size fixed, in which case we are having some time dependence in the co-moving coordinates, or we let the box expand. It doesn't really matter. We'll be always looking at fixed points in time and then another fixed point in time. We just have to make a choice, and our choice here is going to be that we choose commonly coordinate and let the size of the box that we consider grow along with the universe. Yeah?
When we measure this expectation in the box, we assume that the W is zero outside the box.
Yes.
Why is that? Why do we assume that?
Well, you could just integrate over the entire field, right? But then what would be the observable? Then you're not observing it.
Integrate over B instead of RQ.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we want to know what are the quantum fluctuations observed. If you measure the average of the field over a patch of a certain size, a patch of small size, a patch of large size. Okay, so now assume that at a time eta naught, and now because we work on FRW spacetimes, we have to specify a time. So assume at the time eta naught, the system state is a state omega, which is the vacuum state at that time. So assume it's a no particle state. So assume there is a suitable choice of mode function vk such that this vector 0 that comes with that vk describes the vacuum state and that this is the state of the quantum field. Then the expectation value of the region B averaged field at a time eta later than eta naught can be calculated in this way. So the expectation value is the sandwich between omega and omega of this field operator here. Remember that this is the integral over the field multiplied with the window function, integrate over R3. So this is the observable that our detector that looks at the patch at once is measuring. So what expectation value does this observer find? What you would expect is zero because we start out in a vacuum, right? And therefore, there might be quantum fluctuations, big ones, small ones, but overall, the field should be just as likely to be positive as it is negative. And that should be true for all wavelengths, and so overall, we should expect that the expectation value of the field, even when averaged over a patch, better be zero. And that's what we will find. The state of the system is the vacuum state, we said, and we said that this is described by the vector zero for a corresponding suitable mode function. So we can express it this way. The field operator B is, by definition, the smeared version of the field, the quantum field, smeared over with the window function. And the field phi is 1 over A times chi. And the 1 over A is the scale factor as a function of time. We can just pull in front of all of this. Also, the integral over R3 we can pull out. And the quantum field chi hat can be expressed as usual in terms of the mode functions in the creation and annihilation operators. And then we see that the A operator acting on the 0 and on the vector 0 is annihilating that, so that's a 0. Now, the A dagger operator acting on that is not zero, doesn't annihilate it. But we know that this vector that we obtain in this way is orthogonal to the vector zero. So therefore, that too gives us no contribution. Therefore, the whole thing is zero. Okay. So the average amplitude measured by a detector that looks at the patch at once vanishes in the vacuum state. And that's true no matter how big that patch is. The number L, the size of the patch that the window function is singling out, is not important in this. But now, let us look at vacuum fluctuation. Let us look at the variance, or the uncertainty. So while this value vanishes, the measurement outcomes for this patch measurement are certainly not expected to always be zero. You see, if you have a detector that's looking at a patch of space at once, then we expect that in an ensemble measurement, the answers will sometimes come out to be, well, the field is in this patch on average 3, and sometimes it is, on average it's always 0. It sometimes comes out to be 3, sometimes comes out to be minus 2. You know, the average of the field, and this is what the detector is measuring, could be any number, positive or negative. So far, we've only established that the ensemble average is 0. But that doesn't mean that the variance is 0. So let us calculate the variance. So the variance of the field operator phi b is given by the field operator minus its expectation value squared, and then taking the expectation value of that. As always, the variance is the expected squared deviation from the mean. So it is this expression here. Now, filling in that the state of the system is the vector 0 for a known mode function, and that the field phi is really 1 over a times chi, and then writing out that the phi b is the phi smeared over the window function, we obtain this expression here. Now, I leave it to you to fill in 2 or 3 lines of steps. Basically, the Fourier transform. If you now do the Fourier transform of the chi hat from its x dependence to its momentum dependence, you obtain this expression here. And here you see why I made some comments about the Fourier transform of the window function. See, if we Fourier transform this whole thing, we have to Fourier transform the whole thing, right? This and that. So we get the Fourier transform of the window function into the game. Now, let us assume for simplicity that the region B is spherical with radius L. A moment ago, we said it is a box, but it doesn't really matter. It's just simpler for now to assume it to be spherical, because then a three-dimensional integration can be written, because of the spherical symmetry, simply in spherical coordinates as a one-dimensional integration, where we integrate over the radius in momentum space, and then the angle integrations turn into simply 4 pi, the surface of the sphere, and then we have a k squared, because that's the radius squared in momentum space. So we have to integrate this thing now. Remember what this is? The calculation of the variance of the average field in the patch B. Now, what does the window function look like? Remember, it's 1 over V inside the box or inside the ball, and then it slowly drops down to 0 outside the radius L. Now, by Fourier transform, we can arrange that, or we can arrange this window function to be such that the Fourier transform has a similar shape, actually. For example, if you choose this to be a Gaussian, the window function, then its Fourier transform is also a Gaussian. But you don't have to choose a Gaussian. It's generally a case with Fourier transform that you can arrange that the Fourier transform of the window function is going to vanish, or to be very small, for all k larger than 2 pi over L. Just like the Gaussian with a scale L has a Fourier transform whose scale is 1 over L. Okay? So this integral, in principle, runs from 0 to infinity, but we just saw that this window function cuts it off at 2 pi over L. So we don't really have to worry about the integral to infinity. You see, we just have to make sure that it goes down quickly enough so that this k squared doesn't overwhelm it, or even the V. But we can arrange this. For example, we could choose this to be a Gaussian, in which case its Fourier transform is also a Gaussian, and the Gaussian surely wins over that star. So so therefore, we now have that the integral that we have to evaluate, the integral to calculate the variance of the field, is that integral where we are only integrating up to 2 pi over L, which is when the Fourier transform of W cuts off. You see, the W itself has dropped out now because I've made this very crude but relatively okay assumption that the Fourier transform of the window function is itself a window function, so basically constant until it drops off to zero. You see, I neglect the exact prefactors for the same reason. We are no longer so precise. So now, in the integral, the values of the mode function modulus squared for small k are suppressed because of this factor k squared. Okay? So no matter what those values are, they're not going to contribute very much. So we do another very crude approximation here.
How do we?
Well, because they're multiplied with k squared, and k squared is small if k is small. Okay? So what contributes most to this integral is whatever value it takes close to the upper bound. So we will very crudely replace vk of eta by the value it takes at the cutoff over there. Okay? So we basically by saying that, well, the early values that don't really matter much, we may as well choose the early values to be the same as the late values. By that I mean the values of v for large k rather than small k.
All time, there's only one mode function at all times.
No, that's nothing to do with this, because it may not be true.
Right? This is not restricted to adiabatic evolution. In fact, this will be most interesting when it's not adiabatic evolution. Okay? So we could have that early in the universe was in a vacuum state. And we know which vacuum state it was. We know which mode function it is. Okay? And then the universe may go through a period of adiabatic evolution and through a period of non-adiabatic evolution. It may go through a period of inverted harmonic oscillators or whatnot. It doesn't matter. We can do this calculation, it's going to be correct with this V. Because we know that the system is in that state for this V, for that solution's V. So the mode function V is not going to be an adiabatic solution. It's going to be a complicated solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. It's going to be a very simple solution of this form early on when the universe was in an adiabatic phase. Very simple like this. But then this evolution, the evolution of the mode function may undergo some strange behavior because the universe may go through some strange behavior. But it's still just a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. You see, you can see here that working with the fields and the field fluctuation is much more powerful than working with particles because you don't have to assume adiabaticity at all. As long as you know what the state of the system is, which is to say, as long as you know what mode function corresponds to it, you can calculate any observable at any time, such as this variance here. Okay, so when we make this approximation, then we find that the variance of the average amplitude in a patch is given by roughly this expression here, the mode function at 1 over L, integrated over k squared, and you have this prefactor 1 over a of eta squared, and some decorating prefactors that have to do with pi. So obviously, we can integrate this thing now, because this is no longer k-dependent, so we simply integrate the k squared from 0 to 2 pi over L and obtain a k to the third power. So what we find is that the typical amplitude of quantum fluctuations of size L, be it a box or a ball, typical amplitude of those quantum fluctuations as a function of the size L at the time eta, if the system is or started out in a vacuum state, if it started out in vacuum state, and therefore in the Heisenberg picture it always is, then at time eta, this is going to be the quantum fluctuation of the field. It's going to be up to a constant, 1 over the scale factor squared, k to the third power, mode solution at the time eta squared, and the whole thing evaluated at k equal to 2 pi over L. So we may as well write it in this way. Now what you can see from this is that first of all there's going to be a time dependence. Okay? Just a moment, please. It's going to be a time dependence. It's going to depend on what the amplitude of the mode function is. And it's going to be scaling like 1 over L to the third power if space is three-dimensional. This number would be different if we had a different dimension of space. And what we can see here, too, is that quantum fluctuations in small patches are generally bigger than in large patches. Everything else kept the same because there's an L to the third power in the denominator. So if we look at quantum fluctuations of long wavelength, they're going to be pretty much suppressed because that's going to be a small number. Whereas quantum fluctuations on very small scales would appear to be pronounced, very strong. Yes, there were questions.
The mode function at 1 over L or 2 pi over L?
See, I thought it would be 2 pi over L. Yeah, that's right. But we're not being that precise here. This is the approximation where pi is equal to 1, some people would favor. So, of course. Now, what also we see here is this, that I was saying that there's a dependence on time, and there's a dependence on the modulus of the wave of the mode function. But you see, the mode function itself depends on time. And really, you should look at the two together. The reason is that V is a mode function for chi. Not for the physical field, but for chi. And chi over A of eta is what phi is, what is the physical field. Okay? That's very important. And it will illuminate why it is dangerous to think that we have an amplification of quantum fluctuation. You see? When we look at the mode oscillators for the field chi, then yes, it can happen that the harmonic oscillators become inverted, in which case the solution will turn into a runaway solution with very large amplitude, which is to say that the mode function of the chi, which is the thing that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation for number-valued functions, that this mode function V, mode function for chi, is going to fall off the cliff, right? As long as the mode oscillators are inverted. So the amplitude is going to grow without bound. That's what's being referred to as the amplification of the quantum fluctuation. But whatever big amplitude chi has is going to be divided by A, the scale factor. So if we have a dramatically expanding space-time, then yes, the mode functions chi are going to go off the cliff. But dramatic expansion also means that having a dramatically large denominator here. So you don't really see immediately what the quantum fluctuations of phi are going to be. This is going to be large, and that is going to be large. Exactly the story here, you see. You have V over A, or V squared over A squared. That's because we are calculating the quantum fluctuations of phi, really, as we should. We calculate the quantum fluctuations of the field phi, the thing that the detector is coupling to, the thing that the detector is measuring. And it has this ratio of V over A in it. So what we will find is that this goes off the cliff as the harmonic oscillator is inverted, but that is catching it, and actually they will just match another. And what it will mean is that quantum fluctuations that are naturally stronger at small scales, as we can tell here too, for small L, will actually be dragged out. So as they expand along with the space-time, they just keep their amplitude. So they're naturally of large amplitude when they are small wavelength. And then the space-time expansion is simply letting them keep their large amplitude as they're being expanded along with the space-time. All right? So much for today.
Do fluctuations drive expansion?
In fact, our assumption has been, and we will keep up that assumption, that the fluctuations do not significantly affect the expansion at all. We are assuming that the expansion has its own evolution and that the fluctuations are going to be just a little bit of sprinkling on it. And for that, we will assume that there is a so-called inflaton field phi, which has a huge potential V of phi for some reason that we will discuss. And we will treat this classically, not with quantum field theory, just classically. We will say it's a field with a large amplitude, large potential, and that large potential will mean that the universe expands with a very large power or even exponentially. I mean, not quite exponentially, with a large power. That's the main thing that drives the very early universe. And then we say, well, the assumption here was that phi is a function of eta only, but is spatially constant. We will see the reason for why this is a good assumption or what drives the physics towards this being constant in time, a constant in space. So the assumption is that this does not depend on space. But then we say, well, there ought to be some inhomogeneities in phi, maybe not classically, but quantum mechanically. It's not cannot be avoided that there are quantum fluctuations that make the field phi a little bit space dependent. So we write phi, the full phi of x and eta, as a phi classical, which depends only on eta and not on space. That's the thing that has large amplitude and a large potential. It is the thing that drives the expansion of the universe, plus a small phi that we will treat with quantum field theory, which depends on both space and time. So what we are studying here is this. Okay? And later we will see how we do that decomposition here. And in fact, it will be a little bit more complicated than this, because also the metric will fluctuate a little bit because of that. And we'll have to look at the combined effect of quantum fluctuations of the metric and quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field. But for now, all we're studying is a Klein-Gordon field that is basically zero. And the only reason why it would not be zero is quantum fluctuations. And those quantum fluctuations are assumed to be small enough not to impact to any significant extent the overall evolution of the space-time. Of course, we are going to find that it does impact the evolution, but not so as to overall change it very much, but it will just locally produce dents in the evolution. Some parts of space-time expand a little bit faster, some other parts a little bit slower, and that shows up in red and blue shifts in the CMB. And it will also show up in making condensation of hydrogen into clouds, into galaxies and stars, happening preferentially here and not there and so on, and imprinting a pattern of primordial inhomogeneities in this way. Another one? Okay.
Is it true that the BK modes are largest for small k?
Well,
because then, well, then you make a case where it is more like an angle for small k.
Well,
let's postpone that. It's it could be more confusing than in life. Do you have a question? No. Okay, was answered already? Okay, great. Okay, good. Please reload the lecture notes maybe tomorrow or so. Because I made a few changes and I haven't uploaded them yet to the server.